to explore the level of speech that Neanderthals had. One interesting characteristic of the modern human brain is lateral asymmetry. That is, differences between the left and right sides of the brain. Several different parts of the modern brain are related to language, particularly a couple parts on the left side. Lateral asymmetry in the brain indicates that one part of the body is used more than the other. And the brain's particular asymmetry tells us whether a person is right-handed or left-handed. If we had data to show that Neanderthals exhibited handedness, we could infer that their brains also had lateral asymmetry. In other words, that the Neanderthal brain was capable of language. David Frayer, an anthropologist at the University of Kansas, led a team of researchers who approached this problem in an innovative way. They focused on Neanderthal teeth. Neanderthals are well known for using their teeth as tools, beyond chewing food. Their occlusal surface, where upper teeth and lower teeth meet, is often strangely misaligned. If the teeth were used only for chewing food, the occlusal surface would be aligned because it would be made from the upper teeth meeting the lower teeth. A misaligned occlusal surface indicated that the teeth were used in tasks besides chewing food. For example, when cutting meat or tough plants, Neanderthals held tight onto one side with their teeth, but the other side with one hand. Then, with the other hand holding a stone tool, they would strike down and cut the material held between the teeth and the hand. Sometimes the angle of the stone tool would be a little off, and the sharp edge would scratch against the teeth surface. And the angle of the scratch would differ between a right-handed tool user and a left-handed tool user. Examining the angle of the scratch would therefore give us an idea about the handedness of the tool user. An ingenious idea, isn't it? Results of the analysis showed that Neanderthals were predominantly right-handed, in a 9-to-1 ratio. This ratio is similar to the one found in modern humans, making it more likely that Neanderthals were capable of speech. Neanderthal within you, Southeast Asian within me. Since then, further research has shown that Neanderthals were not primitive people howling like animals. Neanderthals used tools and survived in an extremely difficult environment. They knew how to decorate their bodies using a red dye called ochre, and they buried their dead with care. It is highly likely that they spoke language fluently, like modern humans. Furthermore, cave art, which used to be thought of as a unique invention of modern humans, was likely started by Neanderthals. Some say that history advances in spirals. Germany, the site where the first Neanderthal fossil was discovered, was home to one of the most racist regimes in the 20th century. Yet now there is a movement among Germans to acknowledge and celebrate Neanderthals as their ancestors. One can see German youth wearing T-shirts that say, "Ich bin ein Neandertaler," a play on John F. Kennedy's famous quote, "Ich bin ein Berliner," from a speech he gave when visiting Berlin in 1963. Does this mean that Neanderthals are being welcomed into our ancestry? I am cautiously optimistic that the racist imagery of Neanderthals is slowly becoming a thing of the past. This racist view, like the racist colonial view of indigenous peoples, is being re-examined and hopefully disappearing. Our societies are finally embracing and celebrating their diversity. As I continue to think about Neanderthals, I also think about Korea, the country of my birth. Korea is a nation extremely interested in its ancestry, and Koreans tend to validate themselves by depicting their ancestors in heroic scenes. But that's a little strange when you think about it. What makes an ancestor heroic or not? In school, I learned that the ancestors of Koreans came from northeastern Asia, or Siberia. We Koreans generally like the idea that we descended from people at the northeastern end of the Asian continent. But what if we were told that our ancestors came from Southeast Asia? Would Koreans recoil at this thought of having a dark-skinned, smaller-bodied ancestry? And would that feeling of resistance come from the racist bias that many Koreans hold toward Southeast Asians right now? How would such an attitude be different from the bias that Europeans had against the Neanderthals in the beginning of the 20th century? As scientifically grounded as we may imagine ourselves to be, it is also important to remember that our social ideas about ourselves bias the way we pursue questions about our past and our ancestors. Chapter 18. The Molecular Clock Does Not Keep Time. With their big shoulders and thick chest, arms, and legs, Neanderthals appear to have been quite robust. In today's language, you might say that Neanderthals were buff. Or, if you want to put a more negative spin on it, they were savage. Neanderthals share a lot of morphological similarities with modern humans. Although paleoanthropologists now know that Neanderthals were ancestors to modern humans, at one time they wondered how Neanderthals, with such muscular, savage bodies, could be directly linked to modern, civilized humans. The idea that Neanderthals were ancestral to modern humans was famously challenged in a 1987 paper, published in the journal Nature by the research team led by Rebecca Kahn, then at UC Berkeley, and now at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. An analysis of mitochondrial DNA of modern humans from worldwide samples led to the conclusion that Neanderthals and modern humans did not interbreed. As described in the previous chapter, however, Svante Paabo later showed that humans and Neanderthals did indeed interbreed. At the time of Kahn and her team's publication in 1987, it was thought to be an amazing accomplishment to be able to study extinct ancestral humans using genetics from modern humans, not fossils. Their work was considered not just technologically impressive, but also an incredibly imaginative feat of research design. How could modern human genes be used to study our relationship with Neanderthals? Kahn's team used a method based on the concept of a molecular clock. It involved tracking the time that had passed since the time of origin of a gene by counting its mutations. The geneticists of the time came to be sure that Neanderthals could not be ancestral to modern humans simply because of the timing calculated from the molecular clock. The time of birth of modern humans was calculated to be less than 200,000 years ago. The place had to be Africa. Kahn's research showed that Africans were the most diverse in terms of genetics, meaning they had been around for the longest period of time. Since Neanderthals had already been living in Europe since approximately 250,000 to 300,000 years ago, they could not have been our ancestors. Case closed. Kahn's research triggered a big wave of human evolutionary studies that also used modern human genes to study the past. Genes from modern humans became a time machine that carried us into the past. In this chapter, I want to talk about this genetic method of time travel, which is widely used in anthropology and other biological sciences. You'll first need a little background in evolutionary science and the life sciences, but then you will learn about one of the most important and controversial fields in modern genetics. So please be patient and listen on. Birth of a molecular clock. Deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, transmits genetic information in all life forms. The genetic information is coded in the arrangement of four bases: adenine, A, guanine, G, cytosine, C, and thymine, T. These four bases are the building blocks arranged within DNA to record and transmit meaning. The process of organizing these bases is like arranging consonants and vowels in a single line, then reading it to see whether it makes sense. One could think metaphorically of DNA as a long necklace made up of four different colored beads, which are the bases. Within this chain, only a portion can be called a gene, which in turn is made up of units of triplets, called codons. Each codon codes an amino acid. The length of a gene can vary. In humans, a functional gene can be as small as 200 base pairs. Since every base is paired with another base, it is customary to say base pairs instead of bases, or as large as 2 million base pairs. Genes are then read by special enzymes and translated into proteins, which play various important roles in the body. DNA goes through an almost infinite number of replications. We start from a single cell and grow to have almost 37.2 trillion cells by one estimation. Some estimate 70 trillion cells. Each cell has its own lifespan and has to be replaced when it dies or is damaged. An adult human male is estimated to lose 96 million cells every minute. Every time a new cell, including an egg or a sperm, is made, DNA is replicated. In the process of these replications, errors in copying are inevitable. Life forms have an amazing ability to correct and prevent errors in DNA replication, but errors still happen. A base can be inserted or deleted within the chain. Sometimes, a wrong base takes the place of a correct one. When this happens, a different codon may result, possibly causing the wrong amino acid to be made, or producing an entirely nonsensical string of bases instead. Such errors are called mutations. What happens to an organism with a mutation in its genes? The Marvel Comics X-Men suggest that mutations may give certain humans superpowers for fighting crime. Mutu Kimura, a geneticist from Japan, offered an alternative view. In population genetics, we can recognize mutations only if they have no effect on our lives. We cannot recognize mutations that have an impact on a single individual. This is the central statement of the neutral theory, one of the most important theories in modern population genetics. It all sounds rather confusing. Let me explain. We align genetic sequences, the chains of bases in DNA, from two or more individuals, and compare each base on the same location in the genetic sequences of different people, to see whether they all have the same base at that location. Suppose one individual's genetic sequence has the base G, guanine, at the fifth base location, and another individual has a C, cytosine, at the same location. Then we can conclude that a mutation occurred at the fifth base location. We do not know whether C became G or G became C. We just know that a mutation occurred at that spot. This mutation could have a variety of possible effects. If the mutation occurred on a coding region, it could cause a change in the amino acid and change protein structure. The different protein structure could then either harm or benefit the individual. If a mutation is harmful to the individual's life and its reproductive fitness, that individual will not be able to leave any offspring. So that particular harmful mutation will disappear from the gene pool sooner or later. When comparing the genetic sequences of living individuals at some later time, we would not notice that a mutation occurred in the past and subsequently disappeared. If a mutation is beneficial, an individual carrying that mutation will leave many offspring. After several generations, the beneficial mutation will spread, until everyone in the gene pool has this mutation. Once everyone has the same mutation version of the gene, we can no longer discern that a mutation occurred and spread to everyone. Because we recognize a mutation from the differences we spot when comparing genetic sequences, we cannot recognize a mutation when the genetic sequences are exactly the same. For this reason, whether the mutation is beneficial or harmful, at some point we will no longer be able to recognize and identify it as a mutation. Alternatively, the mutation may change the codon, but the changed codon may still code for the same amino acid. In this case, the mutation leads to no change in the protein structure and has no effect on the individual's life. Or the mutation may occur on a non-coding region of DNA and have no effect on the individual's life. These mutations that have no effect on the individual's life stay in the genetic sequence and can be recognized as mutations. They don't disappear from the gene pool because they are harmful, nor do they spread to the whole gene pool because they are beneficial. The frequency of such a mutation in a gene pool does change over time, however. As time goes by, the mutation either increases or decreases in its frequency, by random process. This means that if we know the frequency pattern of a particular mutation, we can determine how long the mutation has been around, and by extension, the population that carries it. The neutral theory, based on this logic, made a significant contribution to the field of population genetics in the 20th century. In fact, population genetics after the 1960s can be said to have flourished on the foundation of the neutral theory. Therein lies the irony of the neutral theory. Recall that Charles Darwin was the first to propose natural selection as the core mechanism of evolution. In modern biology, evolution is defined as a change in gene frequency over generations. How ironic that a change in the frequency in DNA has less to do with a selective advantage but more to do with time and randomness. The number of mutations determines how much genetic diversity a population has. In the 1990s, geneticists made an interesting discovery about the genetic diversity of human populations. It turned out that humans are not very genetically diverse. The 1987 study by Kan and colleagues had concluded that the diversity in human mitochondrial DNA is surprisingly low. And a groundbreaking 1991 paper on population genetics by Wen-Xiong Li and Lori Sadler, geneticists then affiliated with the University of Texas, was titled Low Nucleotide Diversity in Man. Population geneticists interpreted these findings in the framework of the neutral theory. The low level of genetic diversity found in humans was attributed to recent origin of the lineage. In other words, because humans originated recently, there simply hadn't been enough time for many mutations to accumulate. If the human species did originate recently, however, all early hominin fossil species that had lived all over the world before modern humans must have gone extinct as genetic side branches instead of becoming our direct ancestors. For example, Neanderthals, who appeared in the beginning of this chapter, were once thought to represent such an extinct side branch. Because Asia and Africa did not have many hominin fossils that appeared right before or overlapped with the earliest modern humans, the debate about the origins of modern humans concentrated on the relationship between Neanderthals and modern Europeans. Another exciting fact came out of this population genetics research. When Africans, Asians, and Europeans were compared for their genetic diversity, Africans showed the highest diversity. Since higher diversity means an earlier divergence of the lineage, it appeared that all modern humans must have migrated out of Africa recently. The theory that modern humans originated in Africa about 200,000 years ago gained a strong body of supporters and, aided by advances in modern biology, became the mainstream idea of human origins. It came to be known as the complete replacement model. The molecular clock breaks. Early efforts to study human evolution using genetics all focused on mitochondrial DNA. The reason was that at the time, it was extremely difficult to deal with nuclear DNA consisting of 3 billion base pairs. The mitochondrial DNA genome contains more than 16,000 base pairs, and was studied in many other organisms as well. Most important, researchers thought mutations in mitochondria had no effect on the individual, because mitochondria were outside the cell nucleus. In other words, mitochondrial DNA was deemed neutral. In the late 1990s, however, molecular evolution based on the neutral theory started to be challenged bit by bit. It all began with the widely studied mitochondria. Mitochondrial DNA is maternally inherited. If a woman has only sons and no daughter, her mitochondrial lineage will disappear. And so then will the mutations that occurred in her mitochondrial lineage. Thus, the actual number of all mutations that ever happened in the past may be much larger than the number of mutations we can observe through mitochondrial DNA of living people. We would be greatly underestimating the time of origin if we used only mitochondrial DNA evidence to reach a conclusion. Another challenge arose to the supposed predictability of mutation periods in DNA, calling into question timing estimates based on those mutations. For example, suppose a mutation happens every 100 years. If we observe 5 mutations, we can estimate that 500 years have passed. This is basically how we estimated the time of our genetic origin until now. But what if a mutation happened every 50 years, instead of every 100 years? Then 250 years would have passed, not 500 years as estimated. Alternatively, if a mutation happens every 200 years, then 1,000 years would have passed. And what if mutations do not happen regularly, as predicted? Then we would not be able to tell time at all. And that is what researchers found. As more research showed that the mutation rate in mitochondria might not be constant, it became more uncertain to estimate the time of origin. The much-prized molecular clock did not keep time. Another criticism against the neutral theory came with advances in modern biological sciences. The neutral theory relies on the assumption that mutations in the non-coding region of DNA have no effect on the individual. Research started to show that such mutations do, in fact, affect the life and the reproductive fitness of an individual. The non-coding region had been called junk DNA because it was assumed to be meaningless. But more research is showing that junk DNA plays an important role by regulating or signaling other genes. Even the mutations that do not occur in the coding region can have a beneficial or a harmful effect on life. This means that such mutations are subject to selection, and likewise that the molecular clock, based on the neutral theory, will inevitably be inaccurate. And that's not all. Since the early 2000s, mitochondrial DNA, previously thought not to affect an individual's life, because it was located outside of the cell nucleus, has been known to have an impact as well. Though located outside of the cell nucleus, mitochondria are in charge of cell metabolism. I'll never forget the sense of wonder and excitement I felt as one study after another showed natural selection playing a large role in shaping the genetics of mitochondrial DNA. In hindsight, it now appears ridiculous that we once thought mitochondria, the energy factor of the cell, could be neutral. But back then, such was the power of a prevailing theory. Mystery of Human Origins, Round 2. Today, research on human origins is in a new phase. All the publications that traced ancestry through mitochondrial DNA may have to be questioned and re-examined. Furthermore, geneticists are no longer limited to tracing time through DNA from living people, but are able to directly extract DNA from fossils and analyze it. In 1997, the first such research done at the Max Planck Institute in Germany completely fit the mainstream idea among geneticists at the time, which was based on the neutral theory. It supported the complete replacement model. The mitochondrial DNA from a Neanderthal fossil was quite different from that of modern humans. And the analysis based on nuclear DNA, published in 2006, also showed a big difference in genetics between Neanderthals and modern humans. These studies, however, analyzed only a portion of the whole genetic sequence. From 2010 on, the whole Neanderthal genome was decoded, and analyses based on the genome overturned the results from previous studies. New whole genome studies showed that Neanderthals interbred with modern humans. On average, 4% of the genes of Europeans come from Neanderthals. Support for the complete replacement model, based on the neutral theory, began to weaken. In 2013, it was reported that ancient DNA had been successfully extracted from a 700,000-year-old horse fossil. It seems like it's only a matter of time before ancient DNA from a similarly old hominin fossil can be extracted as well. We are now, amazingly, able to travel through time via our own genes and the genes of ancestral humans. Extra. No junk. Just like the mistaken idea that we use only 10% of our brains, the theory of junk DNA has been disproved, though for a while it seemed to have clear evidence on its side. The human genome is made of 3 billion base pairs. When it was decoded in 2001, the shocking discovery was that this unimaginably large number of base pairs contained only about 20,000 functional genes, genes that code for protein synthesis. That is, only about 1% of the 3 billion base pairs appeared to be functional, with the remaining 99% doing nothing. The small proportion of genes in the genome seemed to support the concept of junk DNA, which had gained a lot of traction not only among geneticists, but among the general public as well. What was this 99% doing just lying around? Cells multiply and divide numerous times over our lifetime through mitosis to make new cells for our body, somatic cells. Numerous multiplications and divisions happen through meiosis when we make gametes, sex cells. Each time we copy 3 billion base pairs for mitosis and meiosis, are we copying useless information? Thanks to ongoing research, we are learning that junk DNA has important functions after all. While it does not code for protein synthesis, it does send signals to start or stop making proteins. When this signaling, controlled by the junk DNA, goes haywire, the result can be runaway cell reproduction and cancer. Whether DNA or the brain, over time, we have mistakenly assumed that certain body parts have no use, merely because we do not know how they are used. Human knowledge spans vast areas, but there are still arenas in which we know nothing. And we need to keep learning before we judge that those arenas contain nothing worth knowing. Chapter 19. Denisovans, the Asian Neanderthals. Neanderthals are perhaps the most studied hominin species in the field of paleoanthropology, probably because we have the largest body of data on them, and they lived close to us in time. In addition, the majority of paleoanthropologists are of European descent, searching Europe for our ancestors. Only recently were other hominins, possibly in large numbers, found to have lived in Asia and Siberian Russia at about the same time as Neanderthals. They are called the Denisovans. Denisovans are closely related to modern humans and share a common ancestor with Neanderthals. Thus, Denisovans are the third hominin group to feature prominently in the heated debate about the origins of modern humans, after Neanderthals and modern humans. The fossil remains of Denisovans were first discovered in a cave called Denisova, near the Altai Mountains of eastern Russia, on the boundary between Russia and Mongolia. Paleoanthropologists have long wondered whether hominins other than Neanderthals, the well-known hominins in Europe, lived on other continents, such as Asia. In the 1970s and 1980s, when I was going to school in Korea, we all learned about the standard stages of human evolution: Australopithecus, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, and finally Homo sapiens, which appeared in the continents of the Old World, Eurasia and Africa, in an orderly sequence. Now we know that Australopithecus is found only in Africa. But back then there were excavations to find Australopithecus in Asia, with China leading the effort. Even as recently as the 1970s, papers published in China announced the discovery of an Australopithecus fossil there, although such claims remain unconfirmed. Given the desire to find Australopithecus in Asia, imagine how much more exciting it would be to find a Neanderthal there. France has been actively involved in excavation efforts in northeastern Asia to find the missing hominin that would fill the gap of time occupied by the Neanderthals in Europe, and so has China. Even into the 21st century, papers published in China, North Korea, and Russia refer to Homo neanderthalensis, a species designation for Neanderthals, or Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, a subspecies designation for Neanderthals. This assessment is often based on traits found in the newly discovered fossil remains that are considered to be associated with Neanderthals, such as projecting eyebrows or an occipital bun. Tools without toolmakers. Despite these efforts, no fossil found thus far in Asia can clearly be called a Neanderthal. In fact, few fossils of any kind exist in northeastern Asia from the period of the Neanderthals in Europe, about 100,000 years ago until about 30,000 years ago. You could almost call this period the Dark Ages of hominin fossils in northeastern Asia. And we're not just talking about fossils. Not even the archaeological stone tools associated with Neanderthals, Mousterian tools, have been found in Asia during this period. Until recently, the most northeastern part of Asia where Neanderthal remains have been discovered has been the Caucasus region of western Russia. In the Mesmaskaya cave, a Neanderthal fossil of a young child was discovered in an archaeological site with an estimated date of 40,000 years old. Because no Neanderthal signature was found anywhere east of this or in Southeast Asia, paleoanthropologists inferred that Neanderthals must not have traveled beyond the Himalayas. Does this mean that hominins did not live in Asia from 100,000 to 30,000 years ago? Was there a gap after Homo erectus disappeared, until the migration of modern humans who left Africa? Many scholars thought so, until 2010, when a new discovery was made, not of a Neanderthal or modern human, but of an unknown third hominin. This new hominin shared a lineage with the European Neanderthals, but was also distinct enough genetically to receive its own special designation as the Asian Neanderthal, the Denisovan. Actually, the idea of a third hominin had been circulating among some groups of archaeologists for quite some time. In the Russian Altai region, where the Denisova cave is located, there was evidence of hominin occupation, stone tools and ornaments, since 100,000 years ago. From the continuous distribution of archaeological artifacts, it seems hominins did not leave this region, but continued to live there for at least 100,000 years. They left behind several different kinds of stone tools, and intriguingly, the tools changed significantly about 70,000 to 80,000 years ago. Discovered in Karabom and Ust-Karakol, these tools were blade tools, a characteristic stone tool of the Upper Paleolithic, widely referred to as the stone tool of modern humans. Actual modern humans, however, do not begin to appear in the fossil record until about 40,000 years ago. There was a mystery here for paleoanthropologists. Another hominin must have made these tools. The period from 50,000 to 30,000 years ago is an interesting time. Hominins of that period hunted during the summer and survived the winter in caves, protected from the harsh cold. Denisova was one of those caves in the Altai Mountains. In the ceiling of the Denisova cave is a natural hole that could even function as a chimney. It was a perfect place to camp out in winter, with a fire. Naturally, this cave was often used by hominins. Strangely, though, hominins during this period left only two cultural signatures, both of them characteristic of modern humans. Hunting tools, probably used as spearheads, were found, along with a necklace made from animal teeth and a bracelet made of stone material. But no hominin fossil was found, and the identity of the makers of these archaeological finds remained a mystery. Then, in 2008, a tiny fragmentary bone was discovered, smaller than a pea. It looked like a pinky bone, but no one paid much attention to it. Because no other hominin fossil had come from the cave, people didn't think this bone was from a hominin. Perhaps it came from a cave bear or another animal living in the cave. Our unknown Asian relatives. In 2010, analysis of ancient DNA extracted from this bone showed that it had belonged to a girl of 6 or 7 years old, with unfused growth plates. Her DNA proved that she was human, but different both from modern humans and from Neanderthals. Neanderthal fossils of a similar date from the Mesmaskaya cave in Russia and the Vindhya cave in Croatia were both also different from the girl's DNA. All this means there was another Neanderthal-like lineage, distinct from the European lineage. Unlike nuclear DNA, which is the same in every cell of a given individual, several different mitochondrial DNA lineages can exist within one individual. Three mitochondrial genomes were extracted from the bone found at Denisova. The mitochondrial DNA extracted from the Asian fossil was different from that of any Neanderthal from Europe or the neighboring Altai region. It was now clear that researchers were dealing with another hominin lineage, in addition to modern humans and Neanderthals. Paleoanthropologists named the hominins represented by the bone and the DNA Denisovans. Later, a molar, a wisdom tooth, was discovered that had a morphology slightly different from that of a modern human or a Neanderthal. A pinky bone fragment and a wisdom tooth do not give enough information to say that Denisovans were morphologically different, much less a new species. Our Denisovan ancestors exist only as genes right now. There are no substantial fossil samples to give us an idea of what they looked like. But in this new era, we can study fossilized species even when only a few fossils are available. We may be living through a time of groundbreaking revolutionary change in paleoanthropology. Geneticists and paleoanthropologists have explored whether modern humans have Denisovan genes, given the history of admixture with Neanderthals. The initial results were strange. Some modern humans did have Denisovan genes, but they were found far from the Denisova cave, all the way south among the Melanesians of Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. On average, 4 to 6% of their genes were found to be inherited from Denisovans. They also shared a percentage of their genes with Neanderthals. They are modern humans, but as much as 8% of their genes could have come from these archaic humans. In contrast, research suggested that only weak signals of Denisovan DNA, less than 4%, were found in East Asian populations, who are geographically much closer to the Denisova cave than the Melanesians are. Considering that Neanderthal genes are most strongly present in modern Europeans, who live where the Neanderthals used to live, this Denisovan geographic mismatch of DNA is a strange finding. How can we explain these results? The most convincing hypothesis is this. Denisovans must have been widespread all over the Asian continent in the late Pleistocene, approximately 125,000 years ago until 12,000 years ago. Then they exchanged genes with modern humans out of Africa, meaning they interbred, and the Denisovan genes that had an adaptive advantage remained in the DNA of modern humans. The Denisovan genes found in modern humans are most often associated with the immune system. Moreover, updated Denisovan ancestry studies have suggested widespread Denisovan admixture of between 1 and 3% in populations from northwestern Russia to northeastern Asia and across the Asian continent, as well as in some European and African populations. Recently, a gene found among Tibetans to which high-altitude adaptation is attributed was found in the Denisovan DNA as well, spurring the idea that whatever the case may be, Eurasians and some African populations appear substantially admixed with Neanderthals and/or Denisovans. How do we explain these surprising patterns of Denisovan admixture? Could modern Asians have moved into Asia after the humans bearing Denisovan genes migrated to Melanesia, and then later spread the Denisovan genes around? No concrete conclusion is possible yet, since the discovery of Denisovans is still quite new. It's also possible that Denisovan genes are indeed widespread among modern Asians, but the mechanisms of their dispersal are poorly understood. It's only a matter of time before larger samples and, hopefully, more fossils are discovered. Right now, the data are insufficient. All the more reason to look forward to further research about our origins. 3 hominin species, 1 Denisova cave. 4 hominin fossil specimens have been found in the Denisova cave so far. A pinky bone fragment, 2 wisdom teeth, and a toe bone, 3 of which have been attributed to Denisovans. Interestingly, genetic analysis of the toe bone showed affinity with Neanderthals. Its DNA looks similar to Neanderthal DNA. In its shape, the toe bone was almost similar to the toe bones from other Neanderthals found in Iraq. In a cave only 60 to 90 miles away from Denisova Cave, a Neanderthal fossil and stone tools were also discovered, dated to be 45,000 years old. It looks like Denisova Cave provided shelter throughout the ages for Denisovans, modern humans, and Neanderthals. From all of this archaeological investigation, here's what we know so far. About 70,000 to 80,000 years ago, Denisovans were living in the Denisovan region of the Russian-Mongolian border. Then, 45,000 years ago, Neanderthals moved into the region, or perhaps they were there already. These Neanderthals left behind their stone tools and a few small fossil remains. Nonetheless, they all appear to have left the area by about 40,000 years ago, and modern humans subsequently took their place. Thus, the Altai region was occupied by 3 different hominins within a short period of time. What happened among these different hominins? Did they interbreed and leave offspring behind? Modern human DNA contains Neanderthal and Denisovan DNA, but it's worth pointing out that Denisovan DNA includes 17% Neanderthal DNA. The 3 hominin lineages seem to have associated in complex ways that we cannot yet fully comprehend. Research continues to add depth to our knowledge, and with this depth comes complexity. The origin of modern humans was never thought of as simple, but our roots are becoming more complicated and tangled than we ever thought before. Chapter 20. Hobbits. Gigantopithecus, with an estimated body size of over 1,000 pounds, was a giant. Refer to Chapter 13. At the other extreme is a hominin of very small size, Homo floresiensis. There is an interesting legend about the island of Flores, Indonesia. The legend talks about Ibu Gogo, a little person barely 3 feet tall, with large feet and fur covering its body. This legend may have inspired the human-like hobbit from The Lord of the Rings, which has big feet covered with hair. In 2003, Australian paleoanthropologist Michael Morwood discovered a small hominin fossil on Flores that looks just like the hobbit described in J.R.R. Tolkien's books. The fossil had a very small body and an unbelievably small brain. In fact, the brain was almost smaller than that of a human newborn. Morwood concluded that this was a new hominin species never seen before, and he named it Homo floresiensis, meaning human from the island of Flores. The news media immediately nicknamed it the Hobbit. The Mystery of the Hobbit. This was not the first time that a hominin presence had been discovered on Flores Island. Though actual hominin fossils were not found, other archaeological evidence had been discovered throughout years of excavation, starting as early as the 1950s. The archaeological evidence dated as far back as 700,000 years ago, and anthropologists estimated that hominins had lived on the island for at least a million years. Morwood's discovery in 2003 provided fossil confirmation of a hominin presence, dating from the period between 60,000 and 18,000 years ago. Compared to their presence on other islands of Indonesia, such as Java, which has hominin evidence from as long ago as 1.8 million years, hominins appear to have arrived at Flores a little late. A complicated problem, however, lurks beyond the simple numerical dates. Any map of Southeast Asia shows numerous islands in the South Pacific. These islands are surrounded by seawater, some shallow and some deep, and a deep water line called the Wallace Line divides this area into two regions, Southeast Asia and Australia. North of the Wallace Line, where the island of Java is, the water is shallow, and during the cyclical glacial ages the sea level was even lower than it is now, meaning that most of the islands in this northern region were connected to the Asian mainland. Animals, including hominins, could easily walk to these islands. The island of Flores, however, is located south of the Wallace Line and is surrounded by deep sea. Even when the sea level was lowest during the glacial ages, Flores was still an island surrounded by deep water. Flores Island was separated from the Asian continent even when other islands in Southeast Asia were connected, and it was therefore accessible only by boat. Given this situation, it was a big deal that hominins had been living on Flores Island for the last million years. How did they get there? No wonder anthropologists were interested. It is not known how hominins arrived at Flores Island, or whether they did so intentionally or by accident. Either way, once they arrived, it would have been very difficult to leave the island. The time period of Flores hominins is similar to the period during which hominins started to live in Australia. Like Flores, Australia is located south of the Wallace Line, and it is isolated in the middle of the ocean. Modern humans, now known as Australian Aborigines, crossed the ocean and settled in Australia between 60,000 and 40,000 years ago. This raises a series of questions. Are the Flores hominins modern humans who crossed the ocean early, like the Australian Aborigines, or are they an extinct relative? The fact that there was only one complete skull among other partial skeleton remains on Flores only enhanced the mystery of the hobbits. Ultimately, scientists were divided into two camps on the issue of the Flores hominins. One side argued that while Homo floresiensis looked somewhat strange and perhaps even had suffered some disease, it was nevertheless a modern human. The other side argued that Homo floresiensis was not a modern human, but a new species with a very small body and brain. The debate centered on the skull's size and shape. A comparison of brain size led to the conclusion that Homo floresiensis was unlikely to be a modern human. The brain of the Flores hominins was slightly more than 400 cubic centimeters, cc, in size, smaller than that of a human newborn or an adult chimpanzee. Even modern humans with dwarfism do not have such a small cranial capacity. Individuals with dwarfism are often barely 3 feet tall, but their brain size is no different from that of an average modern human. The Flores hominin could not be considered a simple example of a modern human with dwarfism. Some researchers suspected microencephaly, a condition recently associated with the Zika virus that leads to a small brain. To confirm, they looked for symptoms of microencephaly that are expressed in the body through brain morphology and retarded bone development. But the results were unclear. The proponents of the Flores hominin as a new species argued that the Flores brain and a microcephalic brain were different, drawing from research published in 2005 by anthropologist Dean Falk and her research team at Florida State University. Using micro-CT technology to examine the inside of the Flores skull, they concluded that although the Flores brain is as small as a microcephalic brain, the morphology is quite different. Columbia University anthropologist Ralph Holloway countered that the Flores skull shape was a result of deformation after being buried underground, and the debate returned to its starting point. Interestingly, these two scholars had been rivals in the 1980s debate on Tongue Child, the Australopithecus africanus specimen that I mentioned in Chapter 11. 30 years later, in 2010, they were locking horns again, this time over the Flores fossil. A trick up its sleeve. New evidence from wrist bones. Since the study of the skull was inconclusive, anthropologists focused on other traits. One of those was whether Flores hominins made tools. Many did not agree that anyone with a brain smaller than that of a newborn or a chimpanzee could make stone tools. The stone tools found on Flores are similar to the Oldowan tools from 2 million years ago. Some argued that there was no way anyone with a 400cc brain could make tools like that. Other scholars focused on the overall body size. The leg bone of the Flores hominin has a length similar to the leg bone of Lucy, the famous Australopithecus afarensis specimen. But it is also similar to that of some of the smallest peoples among modern humans, such as the Akka of Africa, or the people of the Andaman Islands. This observation led anthropologists to argue that Flores was a miniature version of modern humans, smaller because of developmental problems. To prove their point, paleopathologists noticed that the Flores arm and the leg bones were thinner toward the sides, and that they were left-right asymmetrical. They also noted that the tibia, calf bone, was curved. All of this could indeed be evidence of malnutrition and stunted development. But it was not definitive evidence. The curvature of the tibia is within the normal distribution of modern humans, and the asymmetry of arm and leg bones could have been a result of deformation after death. The conclusion of the debate was precipitated unexpectedly by a very small bone. The trapezoid bone, one of the smallest wrist bones. Two such bones were discovered. Since the trapezoid bone forms soon after fertilization, it is not subject to any developmental disturbances that might occur beyond 3 months of gestation. Therefore, its morphology can shed light on whether the individual is a modern human, regardless of nutrition and development. Results of the analysis showed that the Flores wrist bone was similar to that of the early hominins of the Pliocene, who had just begun to make stone tools. This bone suggested that the Flores hominins were more similar to non-human apes than to humans. There are now more data to support the position that the Flores hominin is indeed a new species, different from modern humans. Why, then, did the Flores hominin have such a small body? One prominent hypothesis suggested that insular dwarfism holds the key. Animals isolated on an island experience an unpredictable set of selective pressures, different from what mainland animals face. For example, elephants become smaller, while rats and Komodo dragons become bigger. Additional research is needed to confirm this hypothesis. For instance, we need to know whether being isolated on the island led to a small body, or if the Flores hominins arrived at the island with a body that was already small. A descendant of Australopithecus? The lengths of arm and leg bones of the Flores hominin and the shape of the pelvis are all similar to those of Australopithecus afarensis and Australopithecus africanus found in Africa. The brain and body size also resemble those of Australopithecus. These facts were quite puzzling to paleoanthropologists. If a fossil specimen that looked like Flores had been discovered in East Africa in a 3 million-year-old deposit, like Lucy, There would be no problem fitting it within what we already knew of early hominin evolution. But the place of discovery was South Pacific Asia, and the Flores hominins lived at the same time as modern humans, whose brains are 1,400 cc on average. How is this possible? Another set of fossils presented a similar conundrum. They were discovered in Dmanisi, Georgia, between 1991 and 2005. The Dmanisi fossils were also found in a deposit with a date similar to that of Homo erectus, but their brain and body sizes were similar to those of hominins far older, Australopithecus. What if the Flores and Dmanisi fossils belonged to the Australopithecus genus? That conclusion would indeed be revolutionary, changing what we know of human history completely, because it goes against all mainstream understanding of human evolution and migratory patterns. Our current model of human origins says that from Australopithecus in Africa, which had a small brain and a small body, originated a lineage with a bigger brain and bigger body. The new lineage ate meat. Then came the genus Homo, which began to travel outside of Africa. Homo erectus is famous as the first world traveler, and it was followed by modern humans. This model implies that Australopithecus stayed in Africa because it simply couldn't leave. Its brain and body were too small. But if the Dmanisi or Flores hominins are descendants of Australopithecus that left Africa, this model breaks down. In particular, it could lead to the conclusion that the genus Homo originated in Asia from one of the descendant lineages of Australopithecus, lending significant support to the Asian origin model. Such a shift would cause a big wave of changes in human evolution studies. For now, all we have is a tantalizing story. 3 million years ago, some populations of Australopithecus perhaps left Africa, followed the prairie land, and migrated into Eurasia. Some of them ended up on Flores Island, in Indonesia, via unknown means. This descendant population of Australopithecus was isolated on the island, surviving until fairly recently in human development, and was eventually rediscovered as the Flores specimen. For this story to be tested properly as hypothesis, more evidence is needed. One complete skull is not enough. Michael Morwood, the discoverer of Flores, passed away in 2013. Who will next discover another skull of equal impact? Extra. They meet again, Dean Falk and Ralph Holloway. Two of the researchers mentioned in this chapter, Dean Falk of Florida State University and Ralph Holloway of Columbia University, have been rivals for decades. Both scholars studied hominin brain evolution using endocasts, meaning casts of the inside of the skull. Their first academic confrontation was in the 1980s. Holloway argued that Tong Child, Australopithecus africanus, had an enlarged occipital lobe, which was indicated by the location of the lunate sulcus in the brain, which he found to be lower in Tong Child than in non-human apes. He contended that the lower position of the lunate sulcus was due to the enlarged occipital lobe. The small brain of Tong Child had been cited as evidence against the idea that Australopithecus africanus was a direct ancestral species to humans. Holloway claimed that although Tong Child's brain was small, its structure was similar to that of the modern human brain, and therefore the specimen supported the hypothesis that Australopithecus africanus was a direct ancestor of humans. Dean Falk countered that the lunate sulcus was not lower in Tong Child, and furthermore, that its position was not related to the size of the occipital lobe. This exchange led to a heated debate that continued for 20 years. The dispute was so famous that I remember one day at a conference I was attending as a graduate student, people were whispering because Falk and Holloway had exchanged hellos as they passed each other in the hallway. This was the first time in decades that they had been seen speaking to each other, people commented. The truce did not last very long. Several years later, the two scholars would engage in battle again, this time over the Flores fossil. Chapter 21. 7 billion humans, one single race? One of the most sensitive and debated concepts in anthropology is race. Some of you may think that, as a society, we have already decided that all humans in the world belong to a single race, and that race is just a racist concept without merit. Case closed. But in reality, the case is far from closed. The topic is still hotly debated, and continued research has not helped close the gap between different positions. Our view of the 7 billion humans, and counting, on this earth is going through a complete overhaul. It is not clear when and where the concept of race originated. There is a long history among human groups of referring to members of one's own group as humans, and members of an outside group as non-human barbarians. Evidence of this practice has been found all over the world in written history, and even among populations without written history. The modern concept of race, as it is often used today, arose within the last couple of centuries. Europeans explored the world in the 15th and 16th centuries, discovered the New World, and pioneered it. By the time Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species in 1859, it was widely known in Europe there were people living in Africa, Southeast Asia, Australia, and the Americas who looked different from Europeans. Europeans debated whether these other people could be considered fully human. Generally speaking, Europeans settled on the use of three race categorizations: white, Europeans; black, Africans; and yellow, Asian, with indigenous people being variously sorted into different racial categories of Malay, Native American, and the like. In the 19th and 20th centuries, the biological meaning of race was debated. The most extreme position was that a different race constituted a different species, and therefore there were three different species of humans in the world. This view implied that people of races other than Europeans, whites, were not human, and therefore that these different races should not be able to bear children together, conveniently ignoring the many interracial children that resulted from European plantation owners forcing themselves upon their African slaves. As more Europeans visited more places in the world, the range of variation in different people they encountered increased exponentially. Some people began to wonder whether there were perhaps more than three races. If so, how many more? Five? Seven? At the turn of the 20th century, the rise of eugenics and the interest in racial purity prompted some European researchers to make it their mission to find out for sure how many races there were in the world. There are no races, only humans. Researchers' efforts to delineate different groups of distinct races proved, in the end, fruitless. The argument that race is a biological concept like species has no convincing evidence to support it. Extremely long periods of isolation during which different selective pressures challenge different segments of a population need to take place in order for a new species to arise. How long does this isolation need to last? Let's consider the case of the Australian Aborigines. Modern humans first arrived in Australia approximately 60,000 years ago. And until the arrival of the Dutch in the 17th century, the Aborigines were mostly isolated for 50,000 to 60,000 years. Perhaps this is the reason Australian Aborigines are often described as having a unique appearance. The Europeans who first met the Aborigines questioned their humanness and forbade intermarriages. History shows that neither the law nor the sense of difference prevented intermixing. Australians and Europeans gave birth to many children from their mixed unions. Biologically speaking, however, members from different species cannot have viable offspring. Moreover, even if offspring result from two different but closely related species, they will not be fertile. A popular example is the infertile mule, born from a union between a horse and a donkey. If Australian Aborigines were truly a different species from Europeans, the children born between them would either be impossible or sterile. And neither of these scenarios is true. If even a 60,000-year period of relative isolation did not lead to a new species, then it is extremely unlikely that a new species would originate from any humans in isolation. If race is not like a biological species, researchers keen on proving that races exist as a natural category might then consider subspecies, a subclassification within the same species. A subspecies is a population that has been isolated to the point that it is on a trajectory to become a different species if the isolation continues. Subspecies are sometimes defined as sharing less than 85% of their genes with the other subpopulations of their species designation.